demonstration time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to Progressive News Network. We have a riotous show for you tonight, and the reason I say that is because you don't know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's being kept from you. The TPP, so-called, is being kept secret because they don't want you to know. It's a treaty. Normally, the Senate gets to discuss and debate on treaties, but you know what? They've got a solution for that, too. They're going to fast-track it. And if you haven't heard what fast-track is a despicable means of fighting the democratic process, of gelding the democratic process, of treating the democratic process with zero respect. Yes, it's being debated, and you're going to hear about it tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, we've got some very special guests. I've got co-host Mr. Luis Cuevas of Progressive Push, an exemplary political progressive who's been leading people not just into intelligent discussion, but he's been helping people get elected who have good, solid, progressive values. We have another special guest, Miss Mickey Royce, founder of the Progressive Roundtable of Palm Beach. She's going to be giving us the news about some events coming up you need to know about. Our first guest of the evening will be Congressman Alan Grayson, who will be giving us an update. He's one of the few congresspersons who's actually insisted on finding out what's in that. Now, when I say our congresspersons have, very few of them have even bothered, but Congressman Grayson has gone in and looked at it. Now, they wouldn't let him take any notes. They wouldn't let him make any copies, but he at least was able to look at it, and he's going to give you his insight into that. And it's some pretty interesting stuff. If you didn't like NAFTA, boy, are you not going to like the TPP. Then we've got Marjorie Holt, conservation chair of the Sierra Club, who's going to give us her environmental take on the TPP. And we've also got Move On's point person for the TPP, and that gentleman is Terry Day. So he's going to talk us about it from Move On's point of view. And then finally, our final guest of the evening will be Jerry Waxman, a journalist, but now the news. this item, you know, you have to mention this because this son of a bitch is so desperate for publicity. I'm going to say this about Senator Cruz, and it's the last time I'm going to mention him and his movement. We have met the press. He was on Meet the Press this morning. We've met the press, and it ain't working for us. Senator Cruz, finally, we have found in Senator Cruz someone who makes Senator Dan Quayle look good. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Cruz. I need to wash my mouth out. Next, Fukushima. You know that we always cover the stories on Fukushima. You know that we always give you the latest news on what's going on in Fukushima. How's this? The operator of the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant says that underwater barriers in the site's port have been breached. The so-called silt fences that are intended to prevent the spread of radioactive material have been clogged, and they are blown. Tokyo's electric power company said on Thursday they found damage in the curtain-like barrier near the intake canals of number 5 and 6 reactor. The silt fences that are supposed to stop the seabed soil from near the damaged nuclear reactors 1, 2, 3, and 4 are polluting the water near the still intact number 5 and number 6 reactors. TEPCO is investigating the accident's cause. It plans to repair the fences once the high tide triggered by the approaching typhoon subsides. The Nuclear Regulatory Authority instructed the power company to measure radioactive levels in the sea near number 5 and 6. The underwater barriers were damaged back in April as well, and they contributed to high waves. On the 27th of September, highly radioactive water accumulating in the underground tunnels at the Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant is spreading to the surrounding soil, according to new data. Radioactive substances of 400,000 becquerels per liter were found in water samples from a well. TEPCO says it detected radioactive materials that emit beta rays, including strontium. According to TEPCO, the unusually high radioactive levels were discovered in water sampled from a well it had recently dug on the seaward side between 1 and 2. TEPCO's Fukushima Daiichi prompts a report. We'd like to announce the measurement results of cesium and all beta in the water taken from the groundwater observation hole numbers 1 through 16 on the mountainside, where former observation was performed, located on the east of units 1 through 4 turbine buildings, are sampled for the first time today on September 26th. A cesium-137, 2.1 billion becquerels, two beta, 400,000 becquerels per liter. They'll continue sampling and analyzing, but there's even more information. The Fukushima voice says that 60 gigabecquerels of cesium-137 and strontium-90 directly go out into the ocean outside of Fukushima Daiichi daily. That's daily. 900 billion cesium-137 per month and 900 billion of cesium of strontium-90 per month, contradicting the Japanese Prime Minister Abe's words. Okay, then Aoyama was told not to release the information about the Fukushima oceanic contamination that was several orders of magnitude higher than that of the past nuclear testing and at least one order of magnitude higher than the contamination in the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea due to 1986's Chernobyl accident. Now, I hear talking in the background. Please, if you're talking and you're not in the show, mute your mic, please. National Geographic's Joda Kanda, an oceanographer at Tokyo's University of Marine Science and Technology, calculated that the plant is leaking 0.3 terabecquerels. That's 300 billion becquerels of cesium-137 per month. From New Scientist, August 23rd, Ken Buciller of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute of Massachusetts says that Kanda's estimate of leakage into the sea from Fukushima is probably the best he's aware of and closely matches figures released on 21 of 100 billion to 600 billion becquerels per terabecquerels per month for cesium-137 and 1 to 0.3, that's 100 billion to 300 billion for strontium. And finally, the last bit of news on the Fukushima front, you'll really like this. Edwin Teller, you may remember, is the father of the hydrogen bomb. His Japanese protege, Michio Kaku, who earned his nuclear physics degree at the University of California, Berkeley, says, "It's not clear that we're going to make it into a Type 1 civilization without destroying ourselves. I mean, look at Fukushima," he said. "There's three simultaneous meltdowns. Do you realize that the core of Fukushima liquefied? We've never seen liquefaction of nuclear reactor core. Three liquefactions of molten uranium, and as you realize, we have still not controlled it. This could spiral out of control any day, a small little earthquake, and the reactor accident starts up all over again. There's been a collapse in the U.S. However, in Japan, we have this raging meltdown that is currently in temporary stasis." On another front, Jamie Dimon recently pled his case personally before your attorney general and mine. And somebody asked, what is it that Eric Holder personally meets with Jamie Dimon? Since when do targets of investigation get such access and solicitude? Do you really think that any other attorney general would have met with Michael Milken when he was being investigated? In case you're wondering what the indignation is about, here's a Washington Post recap. The sage of Wall Street journeyed to Washington on Thursday, but Jamie Dimon's visit was likely was as unlikely as J.P. Morgan Chase's chief has made before. Dimon sought a meeting with Attorney General Holder in an urgent bid to dispose of multiple government investigations into the bank's conduct leading up to the financial crisis and still avoid criminal charges. The deal that Dimon discussed with Holder would involve paying the government at least $11 billion. I'm going to stop here for a minute and let my good friend Mickey Royce read some of the events coming up. But before I do that, I do want to mention that if you go to averyvoice.com, that's A-V-E-R-Y, Avery Voice, V-O-I-C-E, averyvoice.com, you'll see all the news items that I'd like to present to you today. So check that out. Make sure you see those because there's lots more information you should have today. And now, Mickey, the events.
Tuesday, October 1st at 6 p.m., Food Not Bombs and the Broward Homeless Campaign are going to be doing a citizen presentation to the City Commission, challenging state repression against the homeless and the appropriation of the people's Stranahan Park. Three Food Not Bomb speakers are on the list. If you want to go and support, that's at 6 o'clock Tuesday, October 1st. The address is Fort Lauderdale City Hall, 100 North Andrews Avenue, Fort Lauderdale, 33301. Saturday, October 5th, from 11 o'clock to 1:30 p.m., is a march in support of the Fort Lauderdale Airport workers. They will be convening at Plumbers Local 719, that's Plumbers Local 719. The address is 2502 South Andrews Avenue, Fort Lauderdale, 33163. For more information and to confirm your participation, call Rhonda Thomas, and the number is 305-968-5014. Repeat that number, 305-968-5014. And it will benefit about 1,500 workers that get less than minimum wage. It's a long story, but they're really being not treated very well. And so this is to stand up for them in support of the airport workers. And then Tuesday, October 8th, from 5:30 to 9:20 p.m., War versus Human Needs, South Florida, is having a teach-in, a live stream teach-in on Syria. There's a community dinner provided by the First Congregational Church of Lake Worth. There's no charge. And then at 6:30 p.m., there's a live stream teach-in, and speakers include Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, Stephen Miles, coordinator of Win Without War, Nick Burning, communications director of MoveOn.org, and Representative Barbara Lee from the 13th Congressional District of California, moderated by Judith LeBlanc, field director of Peace Action. That will be at the First Congregational Church of Lake Worth in Palm Beach County, 1415 North K Street. That's K as in kangaroo, Lake Worth, 33460. You'll RSVP to Carol Lewis if you especially want to eat. And the phone number is 561-346-4161, 561-346-4161. And then if you want to go kayaking on the Peace River with the League of Women Voters, go to their website. That's November 9th through the 10th. And the kayak, the Peace River is in Central Florida, and I guess it runs to the end of the West Coast. So that's November 9th and 10th. The League of Women Voters is sponsoring that event.
Thank you so much, Mickey. Thank you so much. I want to bring on my good friend, Luis Cuevas. Luis, welcome.
Hello.
How are you tonight, sir?
I am great, brother. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Well, we've got a very important topic tonight, and I'm going to have Congressman Grayson on in just a moment, who's going to talk to us about it. But, you know, what's on your front burner right now?
Well, right now we're dealing with this whole thing about the congressional, what do you say, hijacking of democracy?
Blackmail, yeah. Yeah, one of those terms.
Blackmail, hostage-taking, you know. It's amazing what's going on in there. And I think that the one person that has really been able to nail this down as to what is going on is Senator Bernie Sanders. And he essentially came up and said that this is only the beginning. This is not what they are really after. This is not what the gophers, I don't know what we want to call these people, because they don't want to be called Republicans anymore. They want to be called conservatives. Then again, it's a Tea Party, whatever. But anyway, the whole thing is that they have an end game, and the end game is further along than just the health care program. Their whole end game is the entire safety net that was created with the New Deal program. And that's what they're attacking. You can bet on them pushing for cuts to Social Security, Medicare, what are really prepaid benefits. You see, this whole talk about entitlements, that is a ruse just to not call it what it is. I mean, these are prepaid benefits. They're part of a national, what you could call it, it's a pact between the people of the United States and its government, and people paid to have this Social Security insurance, this health insurance, you see, for their old age, they were promised. And the Congress of the United States have been picking up, nitpicking and taking away from this original agreement between the people and the state. And now what the Republicans want to do is to ultimately take it all away and turn it over to Wall Street. And we know where that goes, right into the stock market. But essentially what they're doing is attacking the safety net of the country, because they don't think it should be done, because they don't think it's any business of the government to do that. The business of America is business, is welfare, is to have corporate entitlements to protect the creators, the job creators, this Ayn Rand type of a creation, as you will. And so what they were looking for a form or a way to push the government, namely the Democrats in Congress, to come to agreements with them and say, okay, we are going to negotiate.
Louis,
you see, yes, sir.
Let me stop you right there. I've got Congressman Grayson on the line. Hold on one
Excellent.
Second.
Okay.
Congressman Grayson, welcome.
Yes, thanks. Good to be joining you.
Well, we certainly appreciate you coming, sir. You are really one of the people who's leading the protection against TPP. And we know that you've gone in there and you've looked at these documents, sir. Can you give us your take on what you learned from being able to read those documents?
Well, what I learned is that it's probably the biggest giveaway of American sovereignty in recent history. These agreements basically allow foreign corporations to negate our laws, our regulations for worker safety, for the right to organize, for environmental protection, for basically everything that we do in order to make this a place worth living. And they do so in a way that is basically irreversible. Once you set up these alternative systems that allow foreign corporations to negate our laws, there'll never be an end to it. These are binding agreements, and it's going to be very difficult, if not impossible, to ever back out of them. But for instance, to give you one example, what these agreements do, it's been publicly reported, is set up tribunals before the United Nations and the World Bank that allow only foreign corporations, not U.S. corporations, to sue and get money judgments against the taxpayers whenever they claim U.S. law or regulation is causing them lost profits. These tribunals are set up in front of arbitrators, not judges. These arbitrators are in private practice. The foreign corporations can basically bribe these arbitrators and buy them off legally by giving them other legal work to do. And they don't even have to apply U.S. law. They apply whatever law they deem to be relevant. So it's an unbelievable and really disturbing effort on the part of multinational corporations to stage a corporate coup that will basically end our democratic rights to be governed by laws of the people's representatives.
Sir, I've heard some people reduce this to simply economics, that this is strictly a greed-driven agenda. But it seems to me that it strikes so much at the very heart of representative democracy. Basically, locking our courts out of these discussions, it seems to be more than just an issue of greed.
Well, I think that greed is the motivation. What's happened up to this point is, first, even though this so-called free trade initiative that started with NAFTA has been an obvious and abject failure. By the way, before NAFTA went into effect, North American Free Trade Agreement, before NAFTA went into effect, the United States had never, ever, ever in history had a trade deficit of $160 billion or more. Since the year that NAFTA went into effect in the Clinton administration, every single year since then, the United States has had a trade deficit of $160 billion or more. So we've run this experiment. The experiment has failed. Rather than give us free trade and the opportunity to export to other markets like Mexico and Canada, what's happened instead is that we have managed to do something that's almost inconceivable, impoverishing American workers and Mexican farmers at exactly the same time, both for the benefit of multinational corporations. So rather than saying, wait a minute, we should think about maybe repealing these agreements, instead what's happened is we've established the U.S. Trade Representative's Office as an in-the-government lobby for multinational corporations to get as many concessions as they possibly can get in the name of free trade. The people who work for the U.S. Trade Representative are people who either were lobbyists for the corporations, are going to be lobbyists for the corporations, or were lobbyists and are going to be lobbyists for the corporations, multinational corporations that simply parachute in people from their lobbying staffs into the U.S. Trade Representative's office for a few years in order to get these concessions on their behalf at the expense of our sovereignty. So what it is essentially an effort on the part of multinational corporations to hijack the government by means of these so-called free trade agreements, and it's working. It's worked already. We have these so-called free trade agreements with over a dozen different countries. The president has unfortunately completely bought into this anti-worker, anti-middle-class, anti-American agenda, and they're going to keep spinning these things out until the people stand up and say no.
It's come to my attention from my investigations that it's reported that a document reporting to be the investment chapter of that TPP document has been made available. Do you know about that? To the best of your knowledge, is that really representative of what the trade agreement's like?
Well, to show you how malevolent this whole procedure has become, I'm not allowed to answer that question. And I'm a member of Congress, and you're asking a reasonable question. Well, the way that this has developed over the past few years is that our sellout trade representatives made an agreement with other sellout trade representatives from other countries that they would not release any drafts of these agreements until they were all done. And, of course, that's an effort in itself to undermine and defeat representative democracy. My job as a member of the House Foreign Relations Committee is actually to look into these things, see them as they're developing, hold hearings on them, and conduct some kind of oversight regarding these efforts. So what they did is they contrived with other sellouts, trade representatives in other countries, and they said that these drafts are classified. Now, I don't know why anybody would think they're classified. I don't expect that Osama bin Laden would have any real interest, if he were still alive, in what these trade agreement drafts look like. Nevertheless, they claim that for national security reasons, they're not willing to disclose any of these agreements except to 600 outside advisors, 500 of whom are corporate lobbyists. So the lobbyists get to see it. The members of Congress generally don't get to see it. They made an exception for me because I was insistent about it. I'm on the relevant committee. But they showed it to me only on condition that my staff leave the room and that I consider these documents to be classified. Now, in fact, what you say is true, and there have been public reports about what the investment section of these draft agreements, and I say these because there's one for Atlantic countries and one for Pacific countries, what these draft agreements actually say. Certainly, I have no reason to question these public reports. What's the old saying? I couldn't possibly comment, but you might certainly think so. So that's my answer to you regarding whether these classified documents, supposedly classified documents that I've seen, correspond to what's been released through public reports.
Thank you so much, sir, and I respect that oath you've taken. One of the things, I'm just going to go ahead and read it as if this is an interesting thing that may or may not be true, but it says that, among other things, one of the biggest problems that most Americans who work for a living have found in the last several years is there's been a lot of jobs outsourced and offshored. And now it's reported that this new agreement is going to add additional incentives for firms to offshore jobs. Now, if that was true, let's just say hypothetically, if that was true, would you regard that as a good thing for American workers?
It's worse than that. Look, in essence, what these agreements do is they create a conveyor belt that takes U.S. jobs and ships them overseas over and over and over again, and takes away our right as a democratically elected people, a people with government of the people, by the people, and for the people, to do anything about it. Because if we did something about it, for instance, if we established a law that even encouraged investment in the United States instead of investment abroad, if we established a law that equalized the tax burdens right now, that said that you don't benefit tax-wise from sending a job overseas, only benefit if you keep a job in the United States, any action at all, any law, any regulation, any effort on our part to assert our sovereignty would be regarded as a violation and subject to a lawsuit by a foreign corporation against the U.S. taxpayers, according to these published reports.
Right, right. Another mention, or another issue mentioned in this purported document as part of this offshore investment document, says that it's also going to prevent American law on environmental quality to be enforced here. In any of those contentious issues will be taken to this corporate tribunal.
And well, that's right, and this has already happened to Canada, which signed an agreement that had a similar provision in it. In the case of Canada, Canada is concerned about its water supply. So on environmental grounds, Canada said, we don't want to export our water. We just don't want to do it. So the Canadian Parliament, under its authority as the sovereign lawmaking body of that nation, passed law saying we're not going to export our water. We just don't want to do it. And a foreign company sued this the Canadian government in front of an international tribunal because they signed a different agreement. And they sued the government saying that this company wanted to take Canada's water and they thought they would make a profit from doing so, and the Canadian government was preventing them from making a profit, and therefore the Canadian government owed them the money they would have made if they'd been able to export Canada's water to other countries. And that was considered to be a valid claim.
Well, it takes imaginary profits to a whole new level. Let me ask another question. But first, again, I want to thank you so much for the diligence that you have shown above and beyond so many civil servants who are representing us in Congress. But let me ask you this. I'd like to focus in on responsibility for a second. Who is our trade representative, the chief negotiator for us, for theoretically Americans, on this agreement? Do you know? Is that a secret also?
No, it's not a secret. I'll tell you that the U.S. Trade Representative is someone who acts supposedly independently. It's not as if the Trade Representative is someone who is a member of the cabinet. The gentleman's name is Froman, and he was recently appointed by the president. And the in theory reports directly to the president. The fact is that for many, many years, whoever has been in that particular office, since the office was created 50 years ago, traditionally it's been occupied, and this is the current occupant is no exception, it's been occupied by people who have corporate backgrounds, people who come directly from the so-called private sector, usually by CEOs. And, that hasn't changed. So regardless of that, what you need to also understand is that the staff over there consists almost entirely of people who have corporate backgrounds. That's been something that's been true for years and years and years. So, in Froman's case, Froman has something of a government background, but nevertheless, he's been in even government posts that represent the corporate elements, like the Department of Commerce type elements of our government. And his background, apart from that, is to be at Citigroup, the enormous multinational bank, Citicorp.
Thank you, sir. One other question. Who is the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee who's going to be dealing with this interesting piece of treaty legislation?
Well, it's not entirely clear that it's going to come, just to get to the underlying premise of your question, It's not entirely clear that it's going to come to our House committee. The chairman is Ed Royce. He's a California Republican. He's regarded as pro so-called free trade, but otherwise among Republicans at least something of a moderate. What we might see instead is that they try to route this agreement through the Ways and Means Committee, which is responsible for tariffs, because tariffs raise money, and the Ways and Means Committee is responsible for taxation and revenues in general. The Ways and Means Committee is actually, generally more conservative than the Foreign Affairs Committee. Believe me, the Foreign Affairs Committee is not a hotbed of liberalism, but the Ways and Means Committee, in some respects, is even worse than the Foreign Affairs Committee. Dave Camp is the head of the House Committee on Ways and Means. Dave Camp is regarded almost universally as a conservative.
Okay, sir, thank you. The next question I'm going to ask is, many people who are concerned and following this issue closely are under the presumption that this is going to be driven toward the Congress through a fast-track process. Could you explain that a little bit for us?
Yes. The fast-track process is basically a scheme that's been developed to prevent Congress from actually dealing with these agreements in a normal manner. For starters, these agreements are international agreements between international bodies, and generally speaking, that's a treaty. The administration, this administration, Republican administrations, other administrations, long ago gave up on the idea that they could get a treaty approved for this purpose, because a treaty requires two-thirds vote in the Senate, and that's really, really hard to get. So instead, they pretend that these agreements are not treaties, but rather they're agreements, whatever that is, and they try to enact them the normal way that we enact the law, meaning 50% of the House, 50% of the Senate, plus the president's signature. Or if the president vetoes it, conceivably an override of that veto. The problem is that when they do it that way, what they find is that the normal legislative process ends up being very difficult, because there's so many people who regard these treaty agreements either as failures or as not a good idea to start with. So what they've done in the past is that they've passed a rule called the fast-track rule, which by statute prevents the Congress from investigating these agreements, from conducting oversight of these agreements, from conducting anything more than marginal efforts to have hearings on these agreements, establishes a calendar, a very tight calendar that requires action by both the House and the Senate within a very short period of time so that nobody has too much time to think about it, and prevents amendments to the agreements once the president has submitted them as treaties. Neither the House nor the Senate typically can amend whatever the president submits. We have no other law like that. Whether you're talking about national security, or whether you're talking about housing, or you're talking about health care, or you're talking about taxation, literally, we have no other law where the president can submit a document and the Senate and the House have to vote on it within a certain period of time without amendments. It simply doesn't exist. So the corporations, having a complete disregard and disrespect for the democratic process, instead come up with this fast-track type procedure to basically ram it through the House, ram it through the Senate, and not give any of the normal legislative processes a chance to take hold.
I'm presuming that this legislation has never been tested in the Supreme Court, this fast-track mode.
No, we had it for a while, and then it expired, so it's not currently in place. I don't remember any Supreme Court challenge to it. If there were a challenge to it, I think that if there's a very good chance the Supreme Court would decide that it's unconstitutional as a violation of separation of powers.
Absolutely.
Gives the president authority over the House and the Senate that the president normally wouldn't have, and also very likely a violation of what's called the Rules Clause of the Constitution, since it establishes a procedure that's different from the procedures established by the House and the Senate's own rules.
You know, sir, if I can compliment you for a second, you're a person who comes at this with not just what we might call a simple ideological lens. you're a person who's been in business, you've worked in business, you've been a leader in business, so you're not looking at this with a complete anti-corporate perspective, but I think nonetheless you do not think that these kind of guidelines are good for American business. Is that correct?
No, clearly they're not. I mean, we've lost 5 million manufacturing jobs since NAFTA went into effect because of NAFTA. I think that it's horrible for American businesses. It has hollowed out our economy, created a more or less continuous trade deficit in the range of $500 billion each year, and we somehow have to make up that $500 billion, which we normally do through government borrowing, which increases the national debt and so on and so forth. What it's done is it's severely undermined both the economic base, the employment base, and the consumer demand in America, and probably has substantially increased inequality in America, because what happens is that the people at the bottom lose their jobs, and the people at the top end up making money from shipping their jobs overseas. So it's had, I think, a disastrous economic impact on the United States, and it's amazing to me that we're even contemplating some dramatic extension of what we already have. At the moment, we have trade agreements with barely a dozen different countries, the worst ones being the first ones, the ones with Mexico and Canada. But we have trade agreements with roughly a dozen different countries. These two contemplated agreements would increase that beyond 50. We'd end up with trade agreements with 50 different countries, some of which are wildly different from our own country. You know, Canada's a rich economy. Mexico is a sort of a middle-income economy. They're talking about a trade agreement with Vietnam. In Vietnam, people feel lucky if they make $5 a day. I mean, fabulously lucky if they make $5 a day. Typically, they make $2 or $3 a day. So we are opening up our economy to vicious, unbelievably unscrupulous competition, countries that use slave labor, countries that kill labor union organizers, countries that have no environmental laws, no environmental protection, countries that do nothing for worker safety, countries where people make 50 cents an hour. And those are the countries that we are proposing to allow to permit to have unlimited export rights from their countries to the United States, with nothing corresponding on our end that would be worth the candle.
Well, thank you for that perspective. We certainly appreciate it. Now, let me ask you a question about tactics now. Now, of course, on an issue that's front burner, like something like Syria or something like the charade going on under the guise of the GOP's economic plan, this is an issue that has been kept actively low-key. It's a secret agreement, basically. So it's very difficult to get people alerted to it. I understand from many people involved in responding to this and trying to work against it that the plan now is basically to try to oppose TPP is difficult, but instead to put the focus on opposing the fast track. Is that what you're hearing as well, sir?
Well, I think you'll see opposition to both. I think the nice thing about opposing fast track is that there's no fast track for fast track. So with regard to fast track, there's no excuse. They can't push it through in a matter of a month or two the way they can with the subsequent agreements. We have to have hearings. We have to have oversight. We have to have documents provided by the administration to us. We have to have an amendment process. We have to have a committee process, a subcommittee process. So all these things have to happen in order for fast track itself to take place. That makes it easier for us to effectively oppose fast track. Nevertheless, I think that even if fast track passes, you'll see bitter opposition in both parties, not just the Democratic Party, but also the Republican Party, to the subsequent agreements that get submitted to us, the Pacific Agreement and the Atlantic Agreement. And I've already discussed this. In fact, the last time we had the trade representative come over with their documents to my office, I invited a number of other representatives, both Democratic and Republican. Michelle Bachmann showed up in my office. She wanted to see what this was all about. So what you're going to see is both Democrats and Republicans find it's utterly inexcusable and insupportable to give away our own sovereignty the way these agreements purport to do. Now, there are corporate Republicans who are so much in the pockets of Wall Street, the military-industrial complex, and the energy companies, the oil companies, that they're going to vote for it regardless. But there are these, you know, frankly, some of these Tea Party Republicans who are natural allies because they are just offended by this massive giveaway of American sovereignty as Democrats with a conscience are.
Well, thanks, sir. That's exactly the direction I'd like to go in next. Who would you say are our allies? You seem to think that we may be able to bring some Tea Partiers along simply because of the unconstitutional nature of this giveaway.
Well, I mean, in the House, we have to. We have no choice. So the Democrats just don't have the votes to. Even if every single Democrat were to oppose Fast Track or one of these agreements, we would still need to have at least 17 Republicans, actually 18 Republicans, who would see it our way. There's just no substitute for that given the current configuration. Right now, there's 234 Republicans in the House. There's 200 Democrats. And that means that we have to win over some number of the Republicans in the high teens in order to block anything.
So if for people who are aware and want to lend their effort to this opposition, where would you suggest they send their energy, sir?
Well, we're going to keep trying to inform people at our website and otherwise about these issues. I mean, I think that once in particular, once the administration steps forward and tries to get us to go along with this fast-track approach, then I think that you're going to find an enormous effort, particularly on the part of the labor unions, but I think across the board, in order to try to block it. So we're going to try to keep people informed as best as we can about this, but I'm sure we're not going to be the only ones. And we normally keep people informed through our general website, which is the modestly named congressmanwithguts.com. But
congressmanwithguts.com.
Yes, that's right. But we have actually made an effort to set up alternative trade-specific websites, and we're in the process of doing that. I hope that once that's done, then you and other people who are covering this well will go ahead and make sure that people know where they can find information on our website to try to find out more about this and keep apprised. I will tell you that already we've done some really good organizing in that regard. The Atlantic Agreement was opened up for comment a few months ago. It was published in the Federal Register. The time for commenting was almost up. There had been only 113 comments that were submitted. And we told our people, go ahead and submit comments and explain how you feel about this. And in 48 hours, we had 10,000 comments that were submitted, all negative. So when the time came, they had to admit that the comments had run literally 100-1 against this free trade agreement, this free trade giveaway.
Well, it seems that we've got unions, we've got the environmental folks, we've got the constitutional-oriented folks. Let's hope that this is something that will again, return this process to some kind of democratic dialogue. Is there any final thoughts, sir, any other issues you want to bring up, your take on the current debacle in Congress?
Well, if you're talking about the funding, we're already doing our best in that regard. I was really disturbed by what I saw last night. We had the Republicans keep us on Saturday past midnight to vote on such crazy things as repealing the inclusion of contraception in women's health care programs. That was part of what we voted on last night. And I was disturbed enough about this so that I introduced a two-page bill to fund the government for the rest of the fiscal year starting tomorrow without any giveaways or concessions on anybody's part, and to also prevent any disruption over the payment of the debt by saying that the debt payment is covered through the end of next year. We call that the Anti-Self-Destruction Act, and I introduced that at the Anti-Self-Destruction Act, and I introduced that at 12:30 a.m. Last night.
Incredible. Does that have an HR number, sir?
HR 3213.
3213. Well, we'll be calling you to support that one, that's for sure. Thank you so much for joining us, sir. We really appreciate the work that you're doing. Literally, Florida and the country would be a much worse off if you weren't there. Thank you for all you're doing, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, too. And keep up the good work yourself. You know, there was a Greek politician who said 2,300 years ago, you may not be interested in politics, but politics is interested in you. And right now, given the way that our future is up for grabs here in America, we have no choice. We have to be interested. We have to participate. There's just no other way to do it anymore.
Thanks again. Hope
You're
to have
welcome.
You back.
Take care. All right, thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we'll see.
Well, friends, that was Congressman Alan Grayson with a very sobering and yet hopeful voice on what's going on with the TPP. Luis, let me get your thoughts on that, sir. What's your takeaway from the congressman's speech?
Amazing, I think, that the fact that he himself is kept from being able to talk about some things. I mean, we know that Congress is given secret information by the government, and they are held to that. But the fact that he is so prevented from speaking to the public about it, it's really sobering. And essentially, you know, what we're talking about this, the biggest secret, you know, is the biggest trade secret in the world right now, and where you have, I think it's 12 presidents and two prime ministers sitting down in secret to discuss the future of the world and how to hand it over to multinational corporations is shocking, because that's what it is. I mean, this whole thing is going to essentially grant kind of an immunity to corporations for wrongdoing in areas of health, environmental damage, so on and so forth. And that's really, really pathetic that we are at that stage in the history of the world. That has never, nothing like that has ever happened before, that such a thing could, you know, could come up. You know, when they're talking about, you know, the Republicans have been pushing for this tort reform whereby corporations will be exempt from lawsuits for wrongdoing, now we're going to go not just for citizens, but we are going to see nations being told, no, sorry, you can't control these guys, because they have we have given them immunity, and they can violate, you know, environmental rules, and particularly at a time that is so sensitive when we're having this climate change situation.
You know, it just seems hard to believe that there could be a democratic process such that the end result of it is to gut the democratic process, to take our courts out of play, to remove our leadership from any kind of voice in this, and basically to hand over, I mean, I'm an internationalist by nature, but to see these authorities pass from our civil servants' hands to corporate power is just unconscionable.
I just want to point something out while we're just right on the topic. While you're speaking of this stuff, there are probably more than one option. The one that I'm aware of is a site called Credo Mobilization. That's Credo Mobilization.com.
Great.
And you can start your own petition So pick one of the names that you heard. The one that I remember is Ed Royce because it's like mine, sort of. But the whatever the Ways and Means guy was or whatever, start a petition and direct it to the attention of one of those people. And then it'll go through Credo all over the United States, maybe all over the world, I don't know, and tell, let them know. Because if you remember, Congressman Grayson was talking about, he mobilized 10,000 people or whatever it was, and it made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important for those of us that are smart enough to be listening to this show to remember that we can do something, and letters and emails and phone calls matter. And critical makes a difference. So I encourage everyone to go on Credo Mobilization, CREDOmobilization.com, either create your own petition or look for one that addresses this topic, which would be environmental and labor related, and let's all do it together and let them know that we're not going to take it lying down.
Thank you very much, Mickey. Very good.
Thank you.
Luis, are you seeing among your circle of people, the activists that you know and the people that you talk to, what's the level of awareness you're seeing on this? Frankly, nobody talking about it.
Nationally, there's a high level of awareness of this. There's a lot of discussion. There needs to be more to be put out there. As information to the public, that's one of the biggest challenges, is to put out the information, get everybody to know, awaken everybody's attention to this whole thing, that what they're doing is essentially to create a international, or it's a global corporate state. If you recall, when the League of Nations came up, before the United Nations, the Republican Party completely opposed it on the basis that it would compromise the independence of the United States, the sovereignty of the United States. When the United Nations came up, they did the same thing. They attacked it for the same reason, it will compromise the independence and sovereignty of the United States. But now, when it's the corporations that are compromising the sovereignty of the United States, they are mum, and in fact, they're pushing for it.
It's a shame. That's for sure.
Yes.
Let me bring up another interesting topic. Many of us are aware of the evil, I'm going to just go ahead and say evil work that ALEC does, spreading their pro-gun, anti-woman, anti-voting propaganda out there. Three large international high-tech firms have just signed on to ALEC. Google, Facebook, and Yelp have just recently joined ALEC, for God's sake. So if you use any of these services, if you're on Google searching for things, if you're using Facebook to stay connected to your friends, if you use Yelp, you need to let them know that you don't want them involved in the work of ALEC, preparing legal rules and legislation for your legislators, because the work that they're doing, the pro-gun, anti-woman work that they're doing, the anti-union, anti-labor, anti-environmental work of ALEC, this is not acceptable. You need to raise your voice.
Yeah, it's anti-education. They're going after education. They are telling people, let's eliminate the public school systems and replace it with vouchers for private schools, so that we can have the children of America indoctrinated into whatever all these, religious and political groups come up with.
When you hear people talking about the theoretical budget talks in Washington these days, Luis, are you hearing sympathy or are you hearing solid opposition to these Republican grandstanding?
Oh, there is solid opposition. I think that is anything they have done is to awake a giant. because let me put it this way. You know, when we think about it, in this country, there are far more Democrats than there are Republicans. The problem has been getting all these Democrats out to vote. And now the Republicans have found a way to hit people where it hurts, in their pockets, right in their livelihood, right in their health, right in their families. And people are fed up. They are really angry, and they are coming back with a vengeance, you see. And these people are not students of history. Therefore, they don't realize that if you corner people, if you push people, and if you try to hold them down for whatever reasons you want to hold them down, they're going to fight back, you see. And they are going to start, in many ways, hitting back at you. And the problematic is that poor people are not the ones who start rebellions. They're too busy trying to make a living. But if this middle class that is really hurting, that's where it's going to come back from, you see. And it's going to come back with a vengeance. And we hope that it's, you know, that we can channel it into 2014. And, you know, we're using on Twitter the hashtag, remember in 2014, for all of these things. And tonight, if anybody has, you know, is out there, it's almost 8 o'clock, there is going to be a Twitter bomb, and it's going to be using the hashtag, shut down the GOP. And then a statement to accompany that. And it's going to go all over the internet. So if you're listening and you're out there, go out and hit it on Twitter. Hashtag shut down the GOP. You see. And what we're telling people is, you know, shut down the GOP before they shut down the USA.
That's good. That's very good. That's a new one. I hadn't heard that one yet. Thank you, sir. Always you bring us good information, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have another guest with us tonight. This is Mr. Terry Day, who is working with Move On, and he's the Move On activist on the TPP case. Terry, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing? Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I hear you 5x5.
All right. All right, I wasn't sure if I had to unmute my phone or not for you.
Good for you. Appreciate it.
Right. Richard, thank you for giving me this opportunity. But before I forget, Louise, is he still there?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Louise, there's a book you probably would really enjoy reading. It's called Who Stole the American Dream?
By a guy named
Hedrick Smith.
Yes.
And it ties in directly to almost everything you've been saying. So I thought I'd just pass that on.
Thank you.
Well, number one, Richard, I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to talk to people in the state of Florida mostly.
So what's Move On got in mind to bring together this opposition to the TPP? What's the word for Move On, sir?
Well, let me explain how this all began. We had a group. Move On has councils, okay, small groups of people all across the country. We have quite a few in Florida. I belong to the North Broward County, South Palm Beach County, Move On Council. And we decided a few months back to start looking at the TPP. We had a member of our council, Peter Becker, developed a petition on signon.org. I think you've got the website, right?
Sure.
And I sent it to you and all that stuff, right? Okay. And right now, today, we've gotten 1,888 signatures as of this morning. And this is a petition that is directed only at residents of Florida that we will then take and deliver to the 27 congressional members in the state of Florida. Okay? And we hope to get a lot more. And I would really appreciate it if you would promote it maybe on your website a little bit. Because
sure.
Here's what we know. We don't just say let's say Congressman Grayson. We don't say, Congressman Grayson, we've got 2,000 signatures on a petition and give them a copy of the petition. We give them the copy of the petition and then the name, email address, excuse me. And we say, these are the people who signed this petition. All right? And all of a sudden, his staff, which is usually who gets these things, they're just pacing through this thing, and they go, maybe we better pay attention to this. Okay? Because we got a lot of names on it. And there's another petition out there in an area called Flush the TPP that's basically doing the same thing. But our council, after we held a couple of workshops on the TPP itself, and I think you got that, our little outline, we began to realize the best way to oppose the TPP right now for the average citizen and for the average grassroots group was to absolutely derail the fast track. And that's what we're doing. In Florida, we have about 5 or 6 people working on this. We talked to all these various groups, progressive groups, and everybody else, and we asked them to get their members to go in, sign the petition, and go to the other sites to sign their petitions also. So that's where we are right now. And then luckily enough, someone like you was gracious enough to give us their mic.
Well, as you can imagine, sir, we think it's important that as many people get informed as possible. And knowing the thoroughness of Move On, I'm sure that if they haven't gotten you materials yet, there'll be plenty of them up online and even more for you to spread the good word. So we appreciate that.
Actually, Move On hasn't talked about this issue yet. It's just the local councils that are doing it.
Well, that's where grassroots begins.
That's right. So let me explain a little bit about fast track. I mean, I'm not going to try to repeat what Alan Grayson said, and you know, be like a 10-year-old trying to talk to President Obama in a debate. Understand what fast track is. The Constitution of the United States gives the Congress the authority to negotiate treaties. That's what Alan Grayson said. Okay, and then they would agree, disagree with the treaties. They pass it, and they pass it. It went to the president, and the president could either sign it or veto it. And this was that checks and balances between the legislative and the executive office of the United States. This is what they wanted in the Constitution, the founders. They wanted those checks and balances. President Nixon, you have to go back now in history, remember President Nixon, and the fact that people began to call his actions in his administration the development of the imperial presidency, okay? And Nixon and his group came up with this idea of the fast track, all right, 1973. And he got Congress to approve it, all right? Well, you didn't hear a lot of opposition to it in the Congress for one simple reason. They're politicians. They understand that once they gave him the fast track authority, and he began to make trade agreements with other countries that were not necessarily good to the United States, the congressman could stand there and tell his constituents, hey, not my fault. All I could vote on was whether or not we give them a fast track. That was the Senate. And that was it. That was the end of it. So it gave a lot of politicians an out. And then in 2007, the fast track authority expired. We had some of these trade agreements that were being negotiated, and we find out that Obama's going along with this great big secrecy on the TPP, and he's going to go to Congress and ask for a fast track authority. So that's where he is. And you think the guy who talked about transparency, hope, and everything else wouldn't do this.
Well, I think one of the good things that we learned from Congressman Grayson is that the fast track authority has expired, and they're going to have to reauthorize that.
Right.
So that's really,
why we think.
Yeah, that's one of the best pieces of news I heard in his presentation. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well,
he also said There's no fast track for fast track.
Right. Well, you have to go back and remember the previous U.S. Trade Representative's name was Ron Kirk. And when he stepped down and Trump became the new Trade Representative, Kirk was asked in a public setting why there was such great secrecy in the negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And he made a very simple statement, which basically said, if people knew what we were talking about, this thing would be dead on arrival. And you have to remember, the last recent years, remember CAFTA, Central American Free Trade Agreement? Congress wouldn't approve it. Korean Free Trade Agreement, Congress wouldn't approve it. Congress understands that they have to be careful when they do these things because the people in their districts will hold them responsible. So we go back to NAFTA. That's the first major big free trade agreement. Bill Clinton had to send Al Gore into the U.S. Senate as the president of the Senate to cast the deciding vote on NAFTA. Otherwise, it was 54, 50 against. Gore walked in. Boom. He approved it. He voted for it. So NAFTA became a reality. Now, there was a lot of debate on NAFTA. And if you remember Ross Perot, when he was running for president, he was maybe the second time in history, beside Roosevelt, that we had a viable third-party candidate. When they asked about NAFTA in those debates, Daddy Bush told us it's the greatest thing since sliced bread. Bill Clinton, the governor of Arkansas, who was running also for the presidency, told us it was not only the best thing since sliced bread, but basically said it was sliced bread with peanut butter and jelly on it. And Ross Perot stood there and said, if you pass NAFTA, all you are going to hear is a huge sucking sound of American jobs and American factories going south. The media ridiculed him for that. 3 years later, 600,000 jobs are gone out of the United States. 49,000 factories are gone from the United States. They all went south. And that was the beginning of the decline of the powerful American economic engine. And if you really want to see the results, you see it all the time on all these programs where they show you pictures of Detroit. They just don't show you all those huge manufacturing facilities that are closed, wired off, and empty. So that's what we're doing. We're simply working and asking people, but your congressman, no fast track, of course.
Well, Terry, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been good hearing from you. And, you know, if there's something else we can do to help get the word out for the Move On group you're working with, believe me, you can count on us, okay?
Well, like I said, if you'll simply put that petition site up on your webpage for us,
we'll do.
And also, there's another site if people want to really learn about the TPP. Several groups have
flush
come
the TPP.
Flush and put up flush the TPP.
Okay, thanks again, buddy.
All right, we'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye-bye. Now I'm going to play a short little clip of Senator Warren talking about the TPP from her perspective.
I rise today to talk about trade agreements and the impact they have on our economy. Trade agreements affect access to foreign markets and our level of imports and exports. They also affect a wide variety of public policy issues, everything from wages, jobs, the environment, the internet, to monetary policy, pharmaceuticals, and financial services. Many people are deeply interested in tracking the trajectory of trade negotiations, but if they don't have reasonable access to see the terms of the agreements under negotiation, then they can't have any real input. Without transparency, the benefits of an open marketplace of ideas are reduced enormously. I am deeply concerned about the transparency record of the U.S. Trade Representative And with one ongoing trade agreement in particular, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, for months, the trade representative who negotiates on our behalf has been unwilling to provide any public access to the composite bracketed text relating to the negotiations. Now, the composite bracketed text includes proposed language from the United States and also from other countries, and it serves as the focal point for negotiations. The trade representative has allowed members of Congress to access the text, and I appreciate that, but there's no substitute for public transparency. I've heard the argument that transparency would undermine the trade representative's policy to complete the trade agreement because public opposition would be significant. In other words, if people knew what was going on, they would stop it. This argument is exactly backwards. If transparency would lead to widespread public opposition to a trade agreement, then that trade agreement should not be the policy of the United States. I believe in transparency and democracy, and I think that the U.S. trade representative should too. So I asked the president's nominee to be the trade representative, Michael Froman, three questions. The first, would he commit to releasing the composite bracketed text? The second, if not, would he commit to releasing a scrubbed version of the bracketed text that made anonymous which country proposed which provision? And I want to note here, even the Bush administration put out a scrubbed version during the negotiations around the free trade area of the Americas Agreement. And third, I asked Mr. Froman if he would provide more transparency behind what information is made available to outside advisors. Currently, there are about 600 outside advisors that have access to sensitive information, and the roster includes a wide diversity of industry representatives, and some from labor and some from NGOs. But there is no transparency around who gets what information or whether they're all getting the same things. And I think that's a real problem. Mr. Froman's response to my three questions was clear. No, no, and no. He will not commit to making this information public so that the public can track what's going on. So I am voting against Mr. Froman's nomination later today, because I believe we need a new direction from the trade representative, a direction that prioritizes transparency and public debate. The American people have the right to know more about our negotiations that will have a dramatic impact on our working men and women, on our environment, on our economy, on the internet. We should have a serious conversation about our trade policies, because these issues matter. But it all starts with the transparency of the U.S. trade representative. Thank you, Madam President.
That was Senator Elizabeth Warren talking about the TPP. You know, Luis, I'll tell you, I've never heard her speak that she didn't speak just the most eloquent, beautiful, very simply put, focused truth. It's just amazing. I'm so thankful that she's gotten into the Senate.
That's right. And you know what? She does not need to go around framing anything. She just speaks clearly to the people. And that's the most important thing.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I think in a way there's a tinge of irony. Because here she is, a Harvard professor, and I think a lot of people's expectation is she's going to speak highfalutin, professorial, and she's absolutely not that at all. She speaks simply, plain English. She's a woman from Oklahoma. This is not a person who needs to prove anything to anybody except, my God, she is the truth speaking she is doing in the Senate. I swear, the Senate must spin from time to time, just from the truth she speaks. Let me take a moment to support my colleagues in the progressive broadcasting arena. I hope that those of you who tune in to Progressive News Network will also give a listen to my good friend Gwendolyn Holden Berry and her show Here Be Monsters, my friend Brian Stetton and his show Progress Toward Democracy, Miss Anita Stewart and her show Wise Women Media, Miss Susan Nylon and the Nylon Report, Sita Baguil and her Sita Media, Miss Harriet Lerman and her show The Voice of the People, and Rob Abson and his show Smile. You know, I neglected to mention it, but Rob and his group Plan put together a wonderful book called Fix America, and there's a blurb on the back from Congressman Grayson. It says, this is a textbook for college-level course on what it means to be a thinking, feeling American. I recommend it to everyone with a heart and a head. It's called Fix America, How Each of Us Can Help All of Us. It's available through Amazon. Very low-cost book. It's got essays by Senator Al Franken, Joan Walsh, John Nichols, Colleen Rowley, Barry Eisler, Lee Papa, Carolee Kunz, Cory Doctorow, George Lakoff, Joshua Holland, and I have to say there is an essay of mine on the evolution of human rights from Hammurabi to Independence Hall. A wonderful book, and it should be, as Congressman Grayson said, a Bible for those of us who are trying to contribute and make America a better place. The next piece I want to bring to you is an interview with Marjorie Holt, who is the Sierra Club representative working on the TPP issue. And here she is, Marjorie Holt, the conservation chair of Sierra Club in Florida on the TPP. Let me introduce you. Marjorie Holt, right? And your title with Sierra Club is...
I am the chair and also the conservation chair.
Well, that's wonderful. It's a real honor to have you, by the way. So thanks for joining us. Why don't you go ahead and give us what we need to know about the environmental aspect of this secret negotiation that not even our legislatures allowed to participate in.
Okay, well, at this point, it appears that the secretive negotiations are even becoming more secretive.
Wow.
And I have researched on the internet, and I know there's some concern from the e-commerce group. But with regard to our environmental concerns, one of the large concerns that the Sierra Club has is that this could create an explosion on fracking.
Marjorie, you know, one of the things that I've been able to cull from reading these the excerpts of the secret documents is that environmental regulations or national concerns about pollution are essentially going to be taken out of the hands of any U.S. court and placed in a special international court run entirely for and by corporations. Is that the way you understand it?
Yes, that is what I understand. This free trade agreement does dramatically, in fact, how investment rules affect the United States and other nations. They also threaten the environment and climate protection.
Many people have remarked how odd it is that our President Obama ran as a candidate on a platform that says he will not allow any kind of treaty to supersede a national sovereignty, especially when it comes to health and safety issues. Seems to be a real dichotomy there.
Well, it appears to be. I can't ultimately predict, you know, how this will turn out. But, you know, as it looks now, there definitely is a restriction on the ability of governments to set policies in the interest of the public.
One of the other, I think, interesting, to use a genteel word, for what we've been able to garner from these secret negotiations is that the ability of states or municipalities or even the United States to set any kind of environmental goals or environmental safety levels, it looks like it's going to be completely superseded. One of the critics of the TPP negotiation, who's been crying out for openness, just the most open of administrations, Senator Warren said that there's a reason why negotiations are kept secret. There's a reason why there's fine print in contracts. That's because they don't want you to know what's going on. It seems that there's really little they can say to us in rebuttal when they're trying to keep the information from us.
Well, absolutely. If something is secret and not transparent, you know, how can we judge? How can we really judge that this will be a fair trade agreement? And if a corporation feels that its rights have been violated, or the monetary value of its investment has been reduced, then a new law or policy could set this dispute settlement mechanism. And this could undermine local, state, and federal regulations.
Even Doctors Without Borders has decried this agreement, saying that it actually provides a worse environment for international relations than the previous administration, who many people felt had very little humanist tendencies, let's say. Another aspect of it, there's been complaints from public citizen, both here and overseas, that there's been a huge increase just under NAFTA of investment treaties with such enforcement mechanisms have existed since the 1950s. Yet by 1999, only 69 cases have ever been filed in the International Center for the Settlement of Investment Disputes. That's the World Bank body listed as a venue for investor cases in the leaked text. Now, the ICSID's cumulative caseload is over 385 cases, an increase of over 460% over the last 3 years. That's these investor cases. And according to Grosner's example, most cases are about health and environmental policies, not about expropriation. Over $719 million has been paid out under U.S. free trade agreements and bilateral investment treaties alone, 70% of which are for challenges to natural resource and environmental policies, not traditional expropriations. Tobacco firms are using this regime to challenge tobacco control policies, including a case by Philip Morris against Australia. It seems that this is a largely a backhanded way of undermining environmental regulation. Is that the way Sierra Club sees this?
Well, absolutely. It undermines environmental regulations as well as public health. The opportunity for these corporations to launch these cases against the government could have significant impacts, and definitely when it comes to logging, illegal logging, the Sierra Club is concerned about unsustained fisheries, so it could also deplete areas, the Great Barrier Reef. The illegal logging could significantly, impact many areas of the world, especially our rainforest.
One of the ways I've been trying to help people understand this, I said, imagine this. Imagine that after years and years of citizen activism, the state, some state, maybe even Florida, might enact some environmental controls. But then under the TPP, some international corporation might say, well, we don't want to have to observe these stringent environmental controls. We're not asked to do this anywhere else. And then instead of taking their case to the American court, where there might be some semblance of at least a legal process, this is taken to a corporate international court that's run by and for a circle of corporate lawyers. Is that the case?
Yes, from what I understand, absolutely. And it would be settled, in these tribunals and out of the public's scrutiny. I think that, along with our environmental concerns, this lack of transparency resonates through the negotiations, and even if the Trans-Pacific Partnership is approved by Congress, it's almost like out of sight, out of mind until it impacts us locally or, at the state or federal level.
More and more Americans, more and more people across the planet have been concerned about the abuse of natural resources, about the rather cavalier attitude that's represented by things like fracking or mountaintop removal or pipelines across fragile aquifers. And, you know, there's been a real effort over the last half century to enact environmental laws. And here we have what looked to be at least a democratic, environmentally aware and humanist president turning the clock backwards and handing over control and power and legal authority to an international court run by corporations. It seems to fly in the face of everything both the left and the right, if you'll forgive my political argument. This flies in the face of both the conservative and the progressive side of the political fence. It's an odd stance, it seems. What do you think drives decisions like this?
Oh, financial incentives. If the United States wants to improve our gross domestic product and our exports, this is what the U.S. considers, I think, a great opportunity to expand. And it also goes to the bottom line of the controversy over exporting liquefied natural gas. So I just really think that the U.S. is looking to expand our domestic market. So the dollar is the bottom line.
Well, there was an investment chapter that was leaked a year or so back, and I read some analysis of that, and it mentions that from this trade agreement, the leaked text of the PAC's investment chapter shows that the TPP would limit how U.S. federal and state officials could regulate foreign firms operating within U.S. boundaries with requirements to provide them greater rights than domestic firms, extend the incentives for U.S. firms to offshore investment and jobs to lower wage countries, and establish a two-track legal system that gives foreign firms new rights to skirt U.S. courts and laws. Directly sue the U.S. government before foreign tribunals and demand compensation for financial, health, environmental, land use, and other laws they claim undermine their TPP privileges. Now, in addition to the secrecy, in addition to this invisible, non-transparent process, we understand that the tactic that's now coming into play this fall is a fast track. Could you explain what fast tracking means?
Yes, fast track is a mechanism by which Congress could vote yes or no for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It unfortunately limits Congress's ability to amend the TPP. So it's just a straight yes or no vote. And I understand that in the House and the Senate, there's been draft legislation submitted.
Now, I understand that our colleagues in the labor unions are gearing up a pretty strong effort to try to block this fast track. Is Sierra Club combining with other organizations to oppose this fast tracking?
Yes, the Sierra Club has joined forces with the Communication Workers of America. And this has been ongoing. We also have our own special trade representative, Ilana Solomon, and she has been very actively engaged in going to negotiations at the various countries. So she will be very instrumental in working the fast track.
Well, I really want to thank you so much for shedding some more light on this. Is there any other thoughts you want to share with us from Sierra Club's perspective, either on TPP or related matters, or just a heads up on something we may not know about in Florida environmental issues?
Well, I want the public to know that with the approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that the problem to export liquefied natural gas could definitely expand. And with the loss of the Department of Energy's authority to regulate exports, this could definitely be a very bad climate change option for us. Fracking is not an environmentally friendly process.
Marjorie, I was wondering, you know, for our members of our audience who'd like to participate and help however they can, is there any online sites they should go to? What can you suggest?
Yes, absolutely there is. If concerned citizens want to take action, there is a Sierra Club website. They can link on to www.sierraclub.org and go into the trade section. There is an online petition that goes to our President Barack Obama, and that is take fracking out of our trade agreements.
Great.
So this helps send a message.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, we'll have our guest, Jerry Waxman, on in a few minutes. And before we get to him, I'm going to read you one more news story, and I'm going to get some more feedback from our good friend Luis. But now, the NSA reportedly uses your data to chart American social ties. Efforts by the NSA to track potential suspects and find connections between them have led the agency to collate its reams of data with information drawn from sources that include GPS locators in your cell phone, Facebook profiles, and many other social media sources. The newspaper cites documents provided by Edward Snowden, former NSA contract worker, as well as interviews with officials. The agency can augment the communications data with material from public, commercial, and other sources, including bank codes, insurance information, Facebook profiles, passenger manifests, voters' registration rolls, GPS location information, the newspaper said, as well as property records and unspecified tax data, according to these same documents. The alleged practice is part of a broad attempt to use mountains of data to track and find connections among potential suspects. It could, for instance, determine the pattern of behavior or determine when two people were in the same location or traveled together. An NSA spokesman says, called the Times, all data queries must include a foreign intelligence justification, period. Citing internal NSA memo from 2011, the Times reports that large-scale graph analysis of metadata like that described in the documents can be done without verifying the foreignness of every email address or phone number. The newspaper cites the NSA documents that describe a catch-all database called Mainway, into which a large number of phone numbers, email addresses, and other data flow. An internal NSA bulletin, for example, notes that 2011, Mainway was taking in 700 million phone records per day, the Times reports. And in August 2011, it began receiving an additional 1.1 billion cell phone records daily from an unnamed American service provider, according to the report. Allegations about the NSA program comes days after four senators introduced legislation that targets the NSA's practice of collecting American phone records in bulk, as it was reported Wednesday. After questions, the report confirms that whistleblowers have been saying for years the NSA has been monitoring virtually every aspect of Americans' lives, their communication, their association, even their locations. ACLU Deputy Director Jamil Jaffer said of the actions described in the Times report, the NSA apparently believes it can conduct this surveillance because 30 years ago, the Supreme Court upheld the government's warrantless collection of basic information about a criminal suspect's telephone calls over the course of a single day. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've got it. My final guest of the evening, Mr. Jerry Waxman. Jerry, welcome.
Hello.
Hello there, sir. How are
you
tonight?
Can you hear me?
Yes. You're a little distant. If you can get closer to the mic, that'd probably be better.
Okay, how's that better?
That's a little better. Could be even closer. Or maybe speak up a little.
That's about the best this phone's going to do, but, you know, we'll make a game of it.
Well, luckily, you'll be bringing us important information, so that'll suffice. And also, Jerry, let me introduce you to Luis Cuevas from Progressive Push. Luis, this is Jerry Waxman.
Hello, how are you?
Journalist.
Luis, how are you? I've read your stuff, and I know we're friends on Facebook.
Great, yes.
Jerry, it seems that you've been following this story for quite some time. Why don't you tell us, you attended a meeting just recently on this subject.
Actually, I was at a meeting on Friday night where Marjorie Holt again spoke, and we had representatives of the unions there, as well as a woman named Alisa Simmons, who travels around the country speaking about this. She works for Global Trade Watch and Public Citizen.
Great. So what did you learn during this meeting?
Well, as much as I thought I knew, I found out a few other things. Namely, it was my suspicion, but it was confirmed by Alisa, that the real culprit behind this thing are the banks. Nothing's going to happen without the banks being behind this.
And that's because it's ultimately the banks that are founding the or supporting the corporate point of view?
Well, sure. If you take a look at the 11 Pacific Rim countries, you think Vietnam has the kind of resources it's going to take to put this together? Or, you know, maybe Singapore does, maybe Korea does. Japan, even though they're a wealthy country, doesn't really have available resources. They're borrowing as well. This doesn't happen without the banks going along with this 100%. And frankly, I have a feeling that this is a payback to Wall Street for supporting Obama in 08.
I see. You also mentioned when we talked previously was that there was some discussion about tactics. Now, obviously, you can't talk about all of that. But what can you share us about the approaches that our good friends from the CWA and Trade Watch, etc. What approach do you hear them talking about that you can share with us?
Basically, it's a matter of informing people and organizing. It's a matter of writing to the congressman and getting more involved. I have always been an activist in the sense that I don't talk the game. I'm out there knocking on doors. The best way that you can get people active is to go to your neighbors, knock on their door, and talk to them. And if they're not registered, get them out to the supervisor elections office and get them registered. This is what's holding us back. A lot of very poor decisions during Obama's first term created the fact that we don't control the Congress anymore. And we've got to stop this administration and many of our legislators from making the same mistakes in the future.
Well, not to rain on that parade too much, I have to say that clearly Mr. Frohman is getting his marching orders from somewhere besides Wall Street. He does respond and report to the president.
Mr. Frohman works for Mr. Obama and the White House.
Yep.
And he's out there. I mean, Frohman is just now, again, they're going, I think, next week to Bali for more talks.
I hope the sun shines warmly on them, that's for sure.
I mean, it's an insidious thing. When I did speak with you, I told you that I probably would not be able to finish my article tonight.
Right.
And it's because I have so much more information that it's taking a long time to put it together and get it out. I will have the article out first thing in the morning. I'll probably have to stay up most of the night doing it, but it's got to get out there, and people have got to be aware of what's going on. This is something that, from my point of view as a small businessman, there was a report issued just last week by the Center for Progressive Studies, or I forget the exact name, that says that our participation in the TPP is going to cut the average man's salary by between 5 and 7%. And that the gains we can make would probably, on an international trade basis, maybe increase by 1%. Well, if the average guy is going to lose 5% of his income and he's not getting raises, as a small businessman, where do I make that up when they can't afford to buy my products?
You know, one of the other aspects of this that I've read about from that document portion that was leaked was that they're going to be actually increasing the incentives for offshoring jobs. Now, I think
right.
that should be a relatively easy thing to explain to American workers who've watched the potential job base just absolutely evaporate.
That's true. The problem is American labor right now is so demoralized that it's going to take something to get them active again. AFL just had a convention a few weeks ago where they're trying to come up with some kind of a political strategy. The Florida AFL-CIO just had a convention last week. I'm not sure of all the details there yet, but if labor doesn't get behind this 100%, it's going to be rough going. Right now, they're, according to what I heard from Alyssa Simmons, if Fast Track were to go through right now and they were able to put this thing together before the end of the year, there's a likely chance that it will pass.
Well, one of the things that we learned from Congressman Grayson was that they have to reauthorize Fast Track, which at least should give us another finger hold on the process.
That's correct, and he's absolutely right. What he didn't tell you was that in the Senate, the two people working on that, the Republican is Orrin Hatch, well, you know where he's coming from,
right?
And the Democrat is Max Baucus.
Yeah, Luis, feel free to chime in, buddy.
Luis, come in at any time.
Max Baucus is a man who gave the Republicans the phrase of the train wreck, referring
right.
to
Obamacare. Baucus is the guy who gave us what we now know as the Affordable Health Care Act.
Yeah.
And all the problems that are implicit with it.
You bet.
Yes, because the single payer was off the table.
Absolutely
mm-hmm.
right, and believe me, I know all about it. I spent a couple of days with Jill Stein a few months ago, and she went around getting arrested trying to straighten these things out. I'm almost sorry I didn't vote for her.
Well, I voted for the first time not for a Democrat. I voted for Jill Stein this time. It's time passed.
Good for you. Good for you.
Yeah.
She's a remarkable person.
You know, for years and years, I've been one of those people telling my progressive and my activist friends, hold your nose, vote for the Democrats. Yes, I know they sell you out again and again and again, but really, deep down, they're really for you. Well, I just couldn't say it anymore. I just couldn't.
Well, okay, listen, we're agreed on that. My particular take on the TPP right now is that the reason it's not in the mainstream is because too many of the corporations that are behind this thing control too many media outlets. And, the news directors are told, you keep a lid on this. You know, push anything you want to. As far as I'm concerned, everything the Congress is working for right now is, to me, a distraction. Syria was a distraction. The debt ceiling is a distraction. Shutting down the government is a distraction. Because as horrible as they sound, they'll work out. You know, the Republicans may be crazy, but they're not stupid. They'll take it to the brink as much as they can. And a lot of these issues that we all look at and we get behind, to me, they're red herrings. And, I mean, I've really lost faith in this administration. And it's a shame to say it because, you know, in 08, I was an Obama team captain. I walked thousands and thousands of miles for these people. I knocked on lots of doors. And to say the least, I'm quite disappointed. And this is even worse because when he was a candidate, he mocked Hillary every chance he could get over NAFTA. And he mocked Hillary over the Graham, Leach, Bliley and things like that. These were calculated things. The reason he did that was because he needed to get support of whatever independents he could, and he needed to get support of the Reagan Democrats, who were loyal to no one, and so he did it that way. Every one of his campaign speeches was a coldly calculated thing. If I had to do it all over again, I would not have voted for the guy.
Well, you know, I don't want to get too conspiratorial. Let's stay focused on TPP.
Right.
But let me ask you this. You know, a lot of people who are focused on this say that we need to fight this in the fast track. We need to fight this. And, of course, information awareness is our prime tool. But beyond trying to get the word out and knock on doors with your neighbors, what other tools do you see out there? What else are you hearing be talked about?
I write about it constantly, as you know. This is the one I'm doing now is the fifth article I've written on it since March.
Uh-huh.
And it goes out to a lot of media outlets, and not just my paper, but it goes into the Huffington Post, and it goes into Fire Dog Lake. It goes into Daily Kos. It goes into Tom Hartman's column. I have spoken to Tom Hartman about it, and yet he hasn't, you know, he's got a radio show and he's got a television show. But he as of yet has not gotten on this thing. He's concentrating on other more immediate problems.
You know, I think one of the things they've got going for them is the sheer volume of arenas that were under attack from privatizing schools, basically the pipeline going to these commercial prisons, environmental devastation, the pipeline issues, you know, not to mention all the fake issues. And like I said, you know, Luis, feel free to weigh in. What do you think is our best handle? And I can
this
we've
got
to
make it
you.
As public as possible. It's got to be discussed. It's got to be here in the state of Florida right now. You have 67 counties with Democratic executive committees. This has got to be an agenda item on every one of these committee meetings. The statewide Florida convention for the Democrats is the end of October at Disney World. Somehow, somebody's got to get that on an agenda for delegates to take a stand on. That's another way to disseminate the information to 67 counties immediately. Actually, I've got people working on that.
Well, that would be refreshing because, needless to say, the disenfranchised won't be showing up at the Disney Resort for $200 a night rooms.
Well, this first year I'm not paying to go. I'm just going.
I stopped going some time ago. I can't remember when. But essentially, one of the problems that I see is that they have this convention, and where's the work being done? Because it's obviously not in front of everybody, and people never sit down to talk about these things.
Well, that's true. But you have to get to the platform committee. If it's not the platform, it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these people, they don't realize the consequences because this affects everybody. 98% of the people in this country will affect negatively by this.
Right.
Okay? From the small businessman like me and others to the farmers, to the farm workers, there will be health issues and pesticide issues and all kinds of things like that. It's going to affect college loans because money's going to go out of the system. It's going to affect regular public schools. You know, we pay for all the mistakes this country makes. Somebody was talking about the hundreds of millions of dollars worth of lawsuits. One they didn't talk about was in Canada, where Eli Lilly is suing for hundreds of millions of dollars because Canada had the temerity not to okay one of their patents.
Huh.
So they're suing
them. Sue them.
It's a tremendous problem because once you take the sovereignty away from any country or any municipality or state, you've got problems. No, it won't affect the $7 an hour minimum wage worker. All right? They're not going to ship those jobs offshore. And it's not going to affect too much the $250,000 executive or lawyer or doctor, but it will affect everybody in between.
Mm-hmm.
When we hear stories about secret trade agreements, it's difficult at times to explain to someone that the reason these things are secret is because they don't want discussion. The reason that our congressmen are sworn to secrecy, so that even a progressive activist congressman like our good Congressman Grayson finds himself in the awkward position of saying, I cannot confirm or deny that this piece of document is in fact part of those agreements.
That's right.
To me that it strikes so at the heart of democracy that to call it a corporate coup almost isn't using strong language enough. People do not realize what the handing over of our sovereignty, the cancellation of our judicial system, the removal of our civil servants from the processes that corporations would happily and merrily march us through, it seems to really hearken the destruction of our great country. And it's a terrible thing to contemplate.
Well, sure, but it starts to stem. I mean, yes, it started under Richard Nixon. And they gave him the fast-track authority because to open up China, the Chinese leaders respect power and authority. And if Richard Nixon didn't have the power and authority, we would not have been trading with China. Several other trade agreements, they're doing the same thing here. You've got 12 nations who are looking to Barack Obama as their leader, and if he says, okay, we do it, we do it. Now, Fast Track is a little bit of a loaded gun either way. If he signs he's going to sign the treaty, okay? Fast Track is just a rubber stamp. And I don't think, I know in the Senate there's going to be a problem. It could come down to, again, like in 1996 or 1994, where Biden has to be the deciding vote.
Maybe there'd be
the
a real
chance
filibuster.
For this right now is in the House, where if Alan Grayson and several other progressive members can convince enough Republicans this is a bad deal, and we're in a little bit of luck because right now with the Tea Party, they don't have loyalty to anybody. And if they think it's a bad deal, they'll vote against it. That may be the only chance we have.
It would be an ironic turn of the wheel if we end up having to depend on the rather excitable Tea Party to protect the Constitution in these difficult times.
Right now, and these are things that Elisa and Roger and I discussed Friday night. After the meeting, we went out for drinks and got to know each other a little better. And like I said to you, they opened my eyes to a lot of things, which will be in the article, which you know I'm going to send you as soon as it's done.
Sure, I appreciate it.
You got the videos. Did you see them?
Yes, I did. I watched part of it, yeah.
Well, you know how I feel about it then.
It's, thank goodness this great country has patriots like yourself and Luis and so many others who believe in the Constitution, who believe in the constitutional processes that we've been working to perfect these many years.
I
know it gives me hope.
I'll say this. Luis, even though I don't know you, I don't have a sense of how old you are. Rick and I are basically contemporaries. We grew up in an America that was wholly different than the one that's here now.
I'm up there.
And if you're under 50, you don't really
have
any concept of how this country worked before Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. I know.
You don't.
I know exactly
nobody,
what you're saying.
Unless they grew up in a family like mine, they don't. People 45 and under have no concept of how well this country worked, how productive it was, how the middle class enjoyed the highest standard of living in any country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And even with that, the rich continued to get richer.
Exactly. Until that guy, that actor, and the monkey got to the presidency. Yeah, when we got Ronald Reagan, everything began to go downhill.
Well, I'll tell you what. Go to my blog, and Rich knows what it is, and read my article called "Things Go Bitter with Coke." That's K-O-C-H. And if you're of a certain age, you know exactly what that play on words is.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there are a few civil servants that do remember the Constitution, and I hope we can count on people like Elizabeth Warren and a few others in Congress, and maybe Jimmy Carter will take a stand to help rebuild the Constitutional House. He's been doing so good for the poor. I hope he signs back on to help out here, because our Constitutional House needs rebuilt in a
absolutely it does.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer in constitutional government. And having been a businessman all my life, I understand business. I understand the need to make a profit. But I don't understand a need to be above the rules.
Luis, you had something to say, sir?
Yeah, it's one of the things is that people talk about the Roberts Court. And in reality, you know, we don't have a Roberts Court. It's a Bork Court. It's what Robert Bork had in mind and what he concocted, and that's exactly what we come up with, and what is guiding, you know, the SCOTUS and the decisions that they're making. They're
absolutely
throwing everything, you know, out, you know, common law out, Magna Carta out. You know, if it's not word by word in the Constitution, out. You know, that type of, you know, frame of mentality.
You will not find an argument from me there at all. This is definitely a corporately controlled court.
Yeah.
We're as close to fascism as any country ever got. The difference is that we're not totalitarian about it, at least not yet.
Not yet.
Well,
yeah.
Luckily, you know, all these releases of information by Private Manning and through Edward Snowden, the president has assured us this was all primed for discussion. So let us hope that we still have discussions in the weeks and months and years ahead. Gentlemen,
well,
I also have a feeling
that the reason TPP leaks aren't being discussed is strictly because of Snowden and Manning.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for telling our audience the important facts that you have learned. And I can't thank you enough. I hope you'll come back, both of you, very soon and often. Jerry, thank you, sir. And Luis, thank you, brother, always.
Thank you.
A tremendous stalwart and help to me. So, gentlemen.
Well, it was a tremendous pleasure to be on your program, and I thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys. And we'll talk to you soon. And I'm going to leave them with a little bit of music because, boy, we need something a little positive at the end of this one. Thanks, folks. Thanks again. And hope you take
care. Thank you. Good night.
We'll be talking about women's health next week.
All right.